I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. Today, the continuation of the mystery of Elisa Lamb. Everybody, welcome to another episode of The Prosecutors. I'm joined, as always, by my lovely, intelligent, brilliant co-host, Alice.
I made him say those things. hello, everybody. You have no idea how much I had to pay Brett to say all that, but thank you, Brett, for that very kind introduction. So we are still recording from our own remote locations because we are still under a stay-at-home order during this age of pandemic. Brett, where are you sitting right now?
Well, I'm in our studio. See, I'm lucky. I have all of our equipment. It's just me by myself looking at your empty chair, being sad. This is podcasting in the time of Corona, I guess.
I think you have the better setup of the two of us. I am in my closet. At least there's light in here. I'm in here for two reasons. One, it sounds much better in here. And two, I can hide from my children in here. Don't tell my children that, though. Then they'll know where my hiding space is.
You know, Alice, the audience is going to begin to believe that you harbor some hostility towards your lovely children.
I love my children so much. Anyone with a three-month-old and a two-year-old can tell you that sometimes you just need some me time.
That's true. See, I have an almost seven-month-old, so she sleeps half the day, so I get a lot of me time.
Oh, she's so wonderful.
She is wonderful. I know we've talked about this before, but she is wonderful. So today on the podcast, we're going to continue the story of Elisa Lamb. We spent a lot of time yesterday talking about the autopsy, talking about Elisa Lamb's struggles with mental illness. And we really wanted to do that. We wanted to start that way. So many podcasts jump right into this video that we're going to watch today of the incident in the elevator. But I think having the context of what Elisa Lamb was going through actually makes it much more valuable when you're watching that video. So we hope you'll watch it with us. It's a little weird to talk about a video on a podcast when you can't see it. I'm sure even if you've never listened to a podcast about this story before, you've probably seen the video. But either way, I hope you'll watch it with us. Another thing we want to talk about, and we're going to spend a lot of time on, when we were researching this case, we noticed that after Elisa Lamb was found, her parents filed a wrongful death suit against the Cecil Hotel and the managers of that property. One of the things about a lawsuit, if you're going to file a lawsuit, you're going to take depositions. And those depositions offer information that you would never have about an investigation. Oftentimes, police officers who are involved are deposed. People from the hotel, people who were involved in the investigation are deposed. And the more research we did, we kept seeing references to these depositions, but we couldn't get the depositions themselves. And I'm pretty sure they're not available online. Now, maybe we just didn't find them. Maybe you've all read them before and we look like idiots, but it seemed like they weren't there. So what we did, being savvy lawyers and all, is we went to the Los Angeles County Court website. We were able to figure out the case number. We were able to find the case. Now, it's hit or miss when you're doing this kind of research and you can't do it personally. Some documents are online, some aren't. We got very lucky this time because a summary judgment was filed in this case and all the documents, all the depositions were available as part of those summary judgment motions. Now, Alice has a lot of experience as a civil litigator, so I'm going to let her talk a little bit about what a summary judgment motion is.
Thanks, Brett. What Brett said, we were lucky that these were actually filed in this case, and that's because depositions can be taken for lots of different reasons, and typically they're not filed within a docket, within a court, until it becomes an issue of a motion that you're filing with the court. And so in this case, because a motion for summary judgment was filed, they had to also file their supporting evidence. Now, What is a motion for summary judgment? All that is saying is the court is asked by the parties, usually, like in this case, who is being sued? The hotel. The hotel asks the court to resolve the issues and to find that there's actually no genuine issue of fact that would necessitate a trial. So the only reason you end up having a trial in any case is because there's some issue of fact that needs to be determined by a jury of your peers. But if the court first finds that there is no genuine issue of fact, then the court can determine that a party wins without ever having to go to trial. So that's part of the reason why a lot of cases are resolved before they ever go to trial, especially in civil cases like this one. In this case in particular, you know, the standard is no genuine issue of fact, but that can be a little bit confusing because what rises to that level? What if Elisa's parents say the sky is blue, but the hotel says the sky is green? They're clearly saying two different things. Now, the court can look at the record and determine, well, everyone who was surveyed on this day said the sky was actually blue or was actually green, let's say. And so all of the evidence in this case points to the fact that the sky was green, what the hotel said. So we don't actually have to make all these people come into a room, sit as a jury, and determine whether the sky was green when all the evidence actually points to that the sky was green and there's no dispute. And so that's what actually happened in this case and why you have to file your depositions or any facts that you want to rely on, because the parties get to argue what they would argue to a trial before the court, and it's all in writing. In this case, the court actually did grant summary judgment for the hotel, meaning the case was over and Elisa's parents lost their civil suit. That is the end of the case at the trial level. If, as anyone is able to do typically in a case, if you lose at the trial level, you can always ask another court, an appellate court, to review the district court. You have to point to some mistake that the district court did. And Elisa's parents here did file an appeal, but for reasons that we just don't understand or don't know, they voluntarily dismissed their own appeal. You can always dismiss anything you file yourself. It just goes away. So we have no idea why they dismissed it. We don't know if they decided it wasn't worth the money or the time or the grief of having to drag up their daughter's death. We don't know if it's part of some settlement that doesn't show up on the docket. So for whatever reason, we just know that the case is now ended because on appeal, Elisa's parents decided to voluntarily dismiss their case.
And I think it comes as a surprise to a lot of people who are not lawyers how often lawsuits end at this summary judgment stage. Trials are very rare. Lawyers crave trials because they just don't happen very often. Usually the facts either aren't really in dispute or the disputed facts don't really make any difference, so that even if you resolve the facts in favor of the person who's suing, they still lose on the law itself. And juries don't decide questions of law. That's for judges. If, you know, the case is going to come down to a factual dispute, jury's going to make the determination. If it's going to come to a question of law, that's for the judge. Typically, plaintiffs want to get in front of juries, defense attorneys want to kill a case at summary judgment, and often what happens is even if summary judgment isn't granted, the case dies then because the defendant has a strong incentive to settle. If you can get in front of a jury with a sad-sounding case kind of like this one, you're probably going to win. So that didn't happen here, but what we have is a wealth of factual information because of the lawsuit. And one thing we're going to include is not just the depositions, but the parties actually exchange something where they list undisputed facts. So you can look at that. And these are things that the Cecil Hotel and Elisa Lam's parents agree on. So even though they are ostensibly against each other, on these points they agree. And that's a really good way to figure out facts on the ground where we don't have to speculate.
And one thing we should note about depositions are a tool of lawyers when they're trying to advocate for one of their positions. It is not like a law enforcement officer doing a witness interview. And there is a difference between those two, because typically, I think a lot of us are used to seeing witness interviews like on TV, where they ask all types of questions and they're just trying to figure out, where were you on this night? You know, what were you wearing? What did you see? What did you hear? A deposition can cover a lot of the same facts, but especially in a civil lawsuit, the deposition, because you are limited in how much time you have with each witness, and you're even limited in the number of depositions you can take within a case, the attorneys have to be a lot more directed in how they question, and there's more strategy in how they're questioning their witnesses to basically extract points in order to advocate their view of the case. So while there may be a lot of overlap between those two, I wanted to make that distinction because a lot of people may not be as familiar with how depositions are run. So I say that because sometimes you'll be listening to a deposition, and we'll talk more about this in this case, and you'll find something interesting that comes out in that deposition, but the attorney doesn't follow up on it because they don't care about it for the purposes of their case. And they're not going to waste their precious time, because everything's being timed and recorded, to go down a rabbit hole that may not be pertinent to their own case.
That's exactly right. And there's some interesting things we're going to see in this deposition, both things that answer some questions and raise new questions. So before we get into the video, Alice is going to run through a sort of brief timeline so you guys have an idea of exactly the time frame we're talking about here in this case.
Right. So yesterday we had a long retelling of the story, but we wanted to give you some of the highlights so you had these touch points in mind as we start discussing the evidence in this case. So as you may remember, Elisa arrived to Los Angeles on January 26, 2013. On January 31st, that was the last time Elisa was spotted, and it was by a hotel worker who was at the Cecil Hotel in LA. And as we mentioned previously, Cecil Hotel is located in kind of a less good part of town called Skid Row. It's where there's a lot of homelessness and there's drug use in that neighborhood. Last time she's seen, end of January. Then beginning of February, Elisa is supposed to check in with her family. She doesn't. And so her family notifies the police, and the police begin an investigation. So on February 6th, the LA Police Department released details about the suspicious disappearance of Elisa. They've already done the search of the hotel at this point. They brought the dogs in, but they have not located her. They don't know what happened. February 7th, the LA Police Department holds a press conference also about Elisa's disappearance, trying to get more information from the public. We don't know much more at this point. About a week later, on February 14th, the LAPD release a 2-minute surveillance video, which we're about to watch together, of Elisa acting somewhat unusually in the hotel's elevator. And we'll talk more in detail about that video. We think that they probably released that video to try and see if the public knows something about the disappearance of Elisa. A few days later, on February 19th, after some hotel guests complained of low water pressure and a weird taste in the tap water, one of the maintenance workers goes up to the hotel roof and finds Elisa's body floating in one of the water tanks. Then the next day, on February 20th, the officials issue a do not drink order to the hotel residents after Elisa's body is found in the water tank. Personally, I probably would have hoped they issued that the day before, but that's okay.
Yeah, I think that was one of those, you know, we're going to do this officially, but I have a feeling no one was drinking that water after February 19th. And so that gives you an idea based on what we know. You know, Elisa was probably in that water tank for 20 days, about. And that goes to some of the things Alice raised yesterday, concerns that people have about the validity of the autopsy report and how much we can really learn from it, because a lot happens to the body in 20 days. And I know it probably seemed like we were down on the idea of this being a murder or a crime or the result of a crime yesterday, based on some of that autopsy report. But we do recognize that is an issue. And it is an issue that makes this case a little bit more difficult to solve than, well, a lot more difficult to solve than if they had found her body that day or the next day. So now we're going to take a look at this video. I will tell you, the first time I saw this video, I was just deeply disturbed by it.
And you guys are welcome to watch this video as well. But what we're going to do is we're going to watch it all the way through for the first time. So because this is a surveillance camera, it's just kind of sitting there in the corner, probably unmonitored at this time. And you look into, it's probably located at the back corner of the elevator, and it's looking at the elevator and also the door, but it doesn't move. So that's all we see. And Elisa appears in approximately 3 minutes of the video. So we're going to watch it and kind of narrate what's going on first, and then we'll go backwards and discuss more about what we see or don't see. And you guys get to be sleuths here too. Go ahead and watch it along with us. You may notice something that we don't.
And there are multiple versions of this video online. Some of them have been sped up. Some of them have been slowed down. We'll put one of the versions online, which I think is a fairly accurate version. One question that always comes up about this is whether or not the video is edited. We're going to talk about those depositions later on. The police officer who is deposed says, no, this video wasn't edited. This is the video they saw. You know, whether it might have been slowed down or sped up a little bit is one thing, but there's no missing footage. So we're going to go ahead and start it now. And it begins with the door of the elevator opening, and we see Elisa Lam for the first time. And the first thing she does is she presses what looks like every button in the middle row of the elevator and then sort of steps back into a corner and waits.
And one thing to note is she bends down and like puts her face very close to the buttons, like as if she can't see the numbers. Now she's walking towards the door and she just sticks her head out and looks right left really quickly and steps right back into the elevator.
And now she appears to be hiding in the corner of the elevator where the buttons are. And then she looks out again into the hallway.
And one foot stays in the elevator, or both feet are staying in the elevator, but she's kind of standing so the door can't close. One thing to note, though, the door has not appeared to close at all while she's pressed the buttons. She steps out slowly. She jumps out into the hallway.
And then she makes what's almost like a pattern with her feet. She steps to the left, steps back again, steps out, and now she's standing outside the elevator. You can just see her right arm.
And we should note the button seems to be have been pressed. Maybe, I don't know, that I'm a little confused whether the buttons are pressed, but the door has stayed open this entire time.
Some people speculate that by pressing so many buttons, she's caused the elevator to malfunction.
So she comes back in now and she touches both sides of the opening of the doors. Now she is pressing again all of the buttons. And again, her face is pretty close to the buttons.
My understanding is Elisa wore glasses and she wasn't wearing them in this video. So it's possible that she just can't see very well. Now she steps out of the elevator again.
And we see, okay, now she's starting to gesture with her hands to the right. We can't see anyone, but she's kind of leaned over and her hands are circling as if talking in an exaggerated manner.
And this is about 2 minutes into this video, and this is easily the creepiest part of this video. The way she moves her hands, the way her fingers are splayed out, it appears afterwards she may be counting off her fingers like she's counting reasons. And then she takes a turn to the left and walks off. And I don't think we see her again.
And the elevator door is still open right now.
The elevator door is still open, but relatively soon it closes.
And one thing to note, once the elevator door closes, it doesn't seem like the elevator's moving anywhere. Of course, we only see the inside of the elevator, so we may not know. But then the elevator door opens and then closes again.
Yeah, so it's possible it's now just cycling through, and the elevator door has now closed. It's just cycling through the floors, or it's possible that it's opening on the same floor. I don't know if there's any way to tell.
Yeah, we can't tell because the hallway may look the same on every floor. We don't know, but we don't see her again. And the entire video is just under 4 minutes, but she appears in about 3 minutes of it.
And this is the last time, well, that we have any video of her or any indication of her being alive. And we don't know exactly what happened to her. Now, as you continue to watch the video, the wall has now changed when the door opened. So presumably the elevator is moving up. Now, there is a period of time where she's standing outside the elevator and the elevator never moves. And I don't know why that is. I don't know why it took so long for this elevator to stop moving. Or start moving.
Okay, so we kind of narrated through that video, but there's really no a substitute for you all seeing it yourself, so you may want to go see it. But let's start at the beginning. So it appears, let's talk about what she's wearing. She's wearing this long sleeve red shirt. And then, I could be wrong, Brett, but it looks to me like she's wearing the black men's shorts at that point.
I think you're right, actually.
I think yesterday mentioned that she was wearing the black shorts under her clothes, but these are actually longer. They go to they're like basketball shorts. They go to about her knees, especially because she's a woman and it looks like they're made for men. But they kind of, it may look like a skirt, but I actually think it's the black basketball shorts she's wearing.
I think I always believed it was a skirt, but now that you mention it, I think you may be right. I think those may be the shorts
she's wearing like flip flops, I believe. So it looks pretty casual. Like it looks like she was dressed on top and then maybe went back home or went back to her room and changed into shorts, which I often do where I have a top I'm wearing out and then my bottoms don't match. But it certainly doesn't look like she's intending to go out to dinner or something like that.
No, it doesn't. And I mean, it looks like she's wearing pretty comfortable clothes. I mean, the kind of clothes you would wear just to hang around your hotel room or whatnot. Who knows where she's going? She pushes all the buttons in the middle of the elevator. And why she would do that, I don't know.
One thing I'd like to note is she presumably has been at the hotel for a couple of days now. And there's, I assume, not many elevators, or at least she's probably been in these elevators. I don't know about you, but when I go stay somewhere, I usually take the same path every day, so I get to know the elevator at my hotel. And I think it's interesting that she bends so close to the buttons, even if she's not wearing her glasses, because I typically, if I'm getting into an elevator, even one that I've been in once or twice before, I know where I'm going. And so I just kind of press it without having to really concentrate about what steps to take next. And I think that's interesting here because it's not her first time in the elevator. She's dressed comfortably as in she's probably been in the hotel previously that day, but yet she's kind of concentrating so hard on what button to press.
And every move she makes is exaggerated. When she bends down, like you said, she gets really close. She steps back into the corner like she's hiding. When she steps out of the elevator, it's in a very deliberate way, an almost playful way. I think in another circumstance, if she were 10 years younger, if this were an 11-year-old girl playing a game with someone out in the hallway, you would see her behaving the same way that you see Alisa behaving in this video. And some people who watch this video think she looks scared or panicked. I don't see that at all. I just see someone who is, honestly, it looks like they're playing a game.
I agree. I don't really see her being scared. She kind of does this box step after she jumps out. And the jumping out isn't a scared jump. It's kind of like when you're pretending to spook someone, if you're jumping out from behind a wall, being like, boo, I got you. That's kind of what she looks like. And it's more playful or like playing by herself. I mean, we don't know if there's anyone out there, but I know some people think that she's trying to see why maybe the door isn't closing or seeing if someone's out in the hallway. And while she is looking in the hallway, to me, it's more like she's almost playing a game of hide and seek or something. And with whom? I don't know. Maybe with herself. But to me, again, I agree with you, Brett. I think it looks more playful until, honestly, the talking with the hand. So with the steps and the jumping and the box step kind of looks like a little bit of a game. But then, and even when she steps back into the elevator and steps against, where the buttons are and looks in the hallway, it doesn't look to me like she's afraid someone's following her. It's more like when you're playing hide and seek and you're waiting for someone to come find you and you kind of like peer out like, are they coming? Are they coming? It to me is more of a, you coming for me? As opposed to, oh my gosh, I hope they don't see me.
And before the little box step, she has this playful jump that she does out into the hallway, which I think just reinforces that idea that it's as if she's playing a game. Now, as you said, when she starts talking with her hands, I find it to be disturbing. I find it to be the kind of thing that you would see in a horror movie. And I think that's one of the reasons people treat this as if it were a horror movie. And I know American Horror Story based one of their seasons on this. After the playful jump and the box step and she's standing outside, when she comes back into the elevator, before she pushes all the buttons again, she seems frustrated. She seems like it's sort of like, what's going on? Why is the elevator not moving? I don't know. And then she steps out of the elevator again. And this is when the hand movements begin.
Yeah. And, Brett said that these hand movements are what's disturbing. I agree. Because while her jumps before kind of reminded me of a kid playing, these hand movements don't remind me of a kid playing. They remind me of someone who, it's abnormal. Her hands are kind of bent at the wrists in a weird way. Her fingers are splayed very widely in an uncomfortable manner. I don't see kids playing like this. This is more kind of like, almost like someone's possessed a little bit, like a horror movie, like Brett said. And that's where things start kind of getting weird in my view, because she's gesturing to the side and her hands are pretty exaggerated. You typically probably don't talk like that with, you know, I'm a person who talks with my hands, but your hands usually go along with things you're saying. These hands kind of look like they're just gesturing a little bit wildly. And she leans forward, hunched over as well, kind of bending at the waist in a weird manner. Not as if she's talking to someone who's shorter, just bending in a, again, a weird manner, like her wrists are bending in a weird manner.
And then I really think after that she's counting. I think she's counting off reasons or things or something, because it looks like she's holding up one hand and doing the thing you do, where with the other hand, you know, you're pushing a finger and saying reason number one, reason number two, reason number three. And then adding to the sort of maybe a growing frustration, it looks like she sort of puts her hands up through her hair and turns around and walks off.
And, you know, so she's been standing to the left of the door from our view. So she's on the left side of the camera and we keep seeing basically just a sliver of the right side of her body. And she talks towards her right, but then she walks off to the left. So if she were talking to someone on the right, you would expect that she would either walk towards the person or walk away from the person and the person follows. But we don't see anyone cross, you know, the vantage point of the door. So that makes me believe that probably she isn't talking to anybody.
And for the people who think that she's running from someone or trying to escape someone, all you have to do is watch the beginning of this video. She doesn't run into the elevator. She's not like rushing into the elevator, looking over her shoulder. She doesn't do what you would expect someone to do if they're being chased, which is push one button and maybe push it over and over and over again, trying to get that door to close. She does that exaggerated bend over. She sort of does her finger out like a pointer. And then she points and pushes all those middle buttons. And that doesn't make any sense if she's trying to run away from someone. It doesn't really make any sense under any circumstances, but it doesn't lead you to believe this is someone who is in their right mind, afraid of someone else trying to escape.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, while we're talking about sort of crazy conspiracy theories, there are people online who talk about the elevator game. I do not know what the elevator game is. It's difficult for me to even follow exactly what they're talking about. Apparently, it's something out of South Korea. You're supposed to push buttons in a certain way, and you're supposed to move in a certain way. And if you do that, the elevator will take you to some other dimension. I don't know. It seems utterly crazy to me, other than the fact that Elisa Lam does behave so bizarrely in this, and that box step that she does, it's so deliberate, the way she's stepping in a, it almost looks like she's doing the Viennese waltz. We went to Vienna for New Year's Eve once, and one thing you do is at midnight, everybody does the Viennese waltz. So you have to learn the Viennese waltz. And being horribly coordinated myself, it took me a long time to learn it. But that's what this reminds me of when she's stepping to the left and then stepping back. It's almost as if she's doing some sort of preordained step.
And, you know, adding to that, you know, I can't say that I personally know what it's like to have bipolar disorder, but having read a couple books and memoirs of people who do suffer from bipolar disorder, they have mentioned where they sometimes think they're in this universe where there is a game. And if they do certain things in a certain pattern that make complete sense to them at the time that they're having a mental break, they can make happen whatever they need to. So something as simple as the car won't start, but if I touch, you know, the roof and then the tire, and then I clap my hands three times in that order, it'll work. And, you know, these are just anecdotes and people who have come out on the other side of it, explaining what they thought when they were doing something they thought was completely rational at the time they were doing it. I can't help but think that maybe in her mind, she's like, if I step this way, the door will close or I'll get to the, you know, the floor that I need to be on, because it does seem very deliberate.
And on True Crime Garage, which is one of my favorite true crime podcasts, when they talked about this case, they talked about Dr. Jack Brown. He was a body language expert. He has looked at this video and he agrees that he doesn't see any instances of fear. He sees playfulness. He sees flirtatiousness, but not fear. I see the playfulness. I see the flirtatiousness. I also see frustration at the end. It's pure speculation as to what she was trying to do or what she was trying to accomplish. But watching this video, I don't know how you can come away from this video thinking this is evidence of a crime.
And I see the playfulness, but I personally don't even see the flirtatiousness. I feel like she is acting kind of like a child. And then if you've played with a child, they can get frustrated really quickly. And then it's almost like she played the game. She did everything she was supposed to in the game and it didn't work out the way she wanted. And she's just frustrated. And she leaves the game is what I see.
What I've read before is people, and I think another podcast I listen to a lot of podcasts. Another podcast I listen to, True Crime Murder Mysteries, the guy on that podcast, he's great. He's kind of crazy. He says really weird things that don't make sense a lot of times. But one thing he does well is look at sort of psychology and why people do the things they do. Now, his position on the flirtatiousness, which I actually disagree with, is when she's rubbing her hands through her hair, that's flirtatious. I think that goes to the frustration you were talking about. I think this is somebody who, for whatever reason, she's doing this. She had a purpose. She did the things. It didn't go the way it was supposed to, and now she's frustrated by it.
Yeah. You guys should take a look at this video. Drop us a line about what you think and if we're misreading it.
Yeah, I would love to hear what you guys think. We're going to do that response show as soon as we have enough questions to do it with. I would love to hear your thoughts on this video. And if people are comfortable sharing it, I would love to hear from people who have suffered from similar mental illnesses to what Elisa Lam experienced. We don't know what that's like. We can talk about what we've read. We can talk about what we've seen, but we've never experienced it. So it would be interesting to hear from some of you guys. Like I said, if you're willing to share that anonymously, obviously, sort of what your thoughts are watching this video and knowing her medical history, if this seems like the kind of thing that someone who's suffering from mental illness would do. So we could watch this video and talk about this video forever. People have done it. You know, there are videos on YouTube many, many times as long as this video discussing every aspect of it. You can check those out. But I think for our purposes, we're going to move on from the video to talk about really a few of the theories about this case. And look, there are essentially three: that Elisa Lam suffered some sort of mental break, and this was a result of that. That Elisa Lam, a serial killer, a murderer, someone who wanted to take advantage of her, found her and did this to her, or that this is some sort of paranormal event. And I don't put a lot of stock in the idea that this is some sort of paranormal event, though I'll say this is such a weird case and there's so many weird things about this case that I could almost be convinced that a paranormal entity doing this is more likely than a flesh and blood killer. I think if you were looking for a case where there was some sort of paranormal involvement, maybe this is it. But we're going to talk about some of the weird synchronicities that people have noticed about this case, which make people believe that there's something more than just your run-of-the-mill event going on here.
And, you know, we talked about our rules at the beginning, how we try to look at things logically. But with these synchronicities, we can't help but note that it's strange. It's a weird coincidence. And so we don't know what they mean, but they are so coincidental that they're worth mentioning. And so one of the things is when Elisa went missing in Los Angeles, the city was actually in the midst of its worst tuberculosis outbreak in decades. And the name of the test for tuberculosis is actually called the Lam Elisa test, spelled exactly like her name. And they did not name this test after her. It existed before, she jumped into the public view based on her disappearance. ELISA stands for Enzyme Linked Immunosorbent Assay. we're doing that thing where we try to pronounce things again. And LAM is, I'm going to try to pronounce
it. Good luck
this.
With LAM.
Liporobinomenin. A factor associated with tuberculosis.
That was pretty good.
Thank you. All to say, I don't have no idea if that was pronounced correctly. All to say, though, that that was an acronym that existed before Elisa Lam catapulted into the public eye for her disappearance. And this was during the time that she disappeared. The Lam Elisa test was probably in the news a lot because it was the test for tuberculosis. So we're not saying she had tuberculosis. We don't know anything. It's just that's a pretty big coincidence to have exactly her name be the test
It's so totally bizarre. And like most synchronicities, it's completely unrelated. There is no relation. She did not have tuberculosis. This test was never performed on her. It was just literally at the time her name was in the news. It was in the news for two reasons. It was in the news because she had disappeared, and it was in the news because this test was being used to combat this tuberculosis outbreak. Now, the ELISA part of this test is very common. The enzyme-linked aminosorbent assay is that's the bedrock of how tests are done for really anything. And we're actually going to see it again today. The LAM part, though, is specific to tuberculosis. If there weren't a tuberculosis outbreak, you wouldn't be seeing this. So you're essentially using the ELISA test to detect the LAM aspect. And that's why this comes up. Another thing that's interesting about this case, and if you have little ones in the car, you might want to cover their ears because we'll have to use some inappropriate language. But Elisa Lam was a frequent publisher to her Tumblr page. And in fact, posts were made on her Tumblr page after we know that she was no longer alive, months later, as a matter of fact. The common theory on that is just that she had preloaded some posts and it just continued to post afterwards. So on February 1st, 2013, and this post, given the date, she very well could have been dead. She probably was in that water tank at this point, whether she was dead or not. But one of the posts that day was a quote, and the quote was, "Cunt again. It was odd how men used that word to demean women when it was the only part of a woman they valued." And that is actually a quote from A Dance with Dragons, which was published in 2011. One interesting thing to note for those of you who are big fans of Game of Thrones, that is the last book that George R.R. Martin has managed to publish in the Game of Thrones series. So this case is not recent. It's from 2013. The last book that George Martin published, Elisa Lam was alive. So if you're hoping that he'll finish Game of Thrones before shuffling off this mortal coil, don't get your hopes up. Anyway, so she had published that on her blog, or it was published on that February 1st. When Elisa Lam's body was found, there was graffiti found near the water tanks. In fact, you can see this graffiti on some of the photos of the police as they're working around this water tank. And the graffiti reads, it's sort of in Latin, "Fecto cunt hair summa." Now, if you go on the internet and read this translation, they translate it as, "In fact, she was a cunt." You compare that translation to what she wrote on her Tumblr page, and it almost feels like somebody who knew that that publication was going up or knew that she had published that, and this is a, you know, retort to her. Like, yeah, people use that, and guess what? You were one. I'm going to debunk that just a little bit. I mean, number one, this is one of two graffiti posts. People don't often talk about the other one. It's the same phrase, actually, painted on another part of the hotel, but this one has a date, and it's dated 2012. So whoever did this did it well before Elisa Lam was even in Los Angeles. The second thing, that is not the translation. I took Latin 15 years ago. I think it's interesting that whoever did this decided to do sort of a quasi-Latin phrase, but the only Latin words in this phrase are "fecto" and maybe "summa." "Fecto" means "in fact," so that is correct. "Summa," you know, "cogito ergo sum," "I think, therefore I am." "Sum" is Latin for "I am." It looks to me that that was the only Latin phrase this person knew, or the only Latin word this person knew for "is," and they wanted it to be a feminine term. So like you do in Spanish, they just added an "a" to the end of the Latin word. It would be "erit" if it were "was" or "she was." So I think they just added an "a" to the one Latin term they knew. And then obviously "cunt" and "her" are English terms. So what this actually means, I think at best, is in fact she is her cunt.
And also, it's just interesting that, so you're saying this is not Latin. This is not someone who knows Latin.
No. I think "fecto" is the most interesting thing. I think it's interesting that this person knew that word, because the rest of it is definitely not right. And I think this is really just sort of, this is just an insult against a woman, and it's not even that creative an insult. But I don't think it has anything to do with Elisa Lam. people like to point to this a lot. It is weird. It is weird that she posted that. It is weird that this phrase was found. It's definitely a synchronicity. Does it have anything to do with this case? Does it point to someone killing her for some sexual reason? No, it doesn't.
Do you have thoughts on how they interplay then? Like why kind of, that's a specific term, a specific, you know, degrading term.
And it's rare in the United States. My understanding is in Britain, people throw this word around all the time. I think in the United States, it's really one of the worst things you can say. It's definitely one of the worst things you can call a woman. So it is weird. I mean, it's weird. It's almost inexplicable that this very unusual word, particularly in America, would appear both on her blog, and I don't know what the sensibilities are to this in Canada. I assume it's more like in the United States than in Britain. But it's weird to me that she would use that word. Once again, it's a quote from a George R. R. Martin book, but that she would use that word and then that this would appear. Now, one thing I think is possible, and people have speculated that maybe she was walking down the street. It's a rough neighborhood. Someone called her that. No one in Skid Row, Los Angeles is going to call her that. They're going to call her a bitch if they're going to call her anything. If they're going to yell at her, they're going to call it. Or some equally bad word, but that's probably not the one they're going to go to. I question whether or not this is actually evidence that Elisa had been on that roof before, that maybe the day that she ended up in the water tank was not the first time she had been up there. And honestly, if you don't think this is something that was done to her, there's no reason to think that night was the first time that she was on the roof. I think more likely, and particularly if you look at her history, she even in one of her blog posts talks about how when she travels, she spends too much time in her room and she really needs to get out more. If Elisa didn't want to be around people, but she wanted to see Los Angeles, one way to do that is to go up to the top of the roof and look out and see Los Angeles, but be by yourself. Now, one thing she also would have seen if she were doing that was this graffiti. And I could imagine seeing this graffiti inspiring her to make this post. So in that way, it's less a synchronicity and more a piece of evidence, just not a piece of evidence for the theory that some people think.
That's one of the most compelling things, kind of flipping what a lot of people theorize, you know, that she saw it and then the other way around and it turning into a piece of evidence. But as far as I can tell, no one has really treated this as a piece of evidence that she'd been up there prior to her being found in the water tank.
No, I think most people treat it as a piece of evidence that whoever painted this graffiti was somehow involved in her killing.
Right. And as we said earlier, there really doesn't seem to be any sort of evidence of a crime or a someone doing this to her. So another synchronicity that is just worth noting, because it's just too eerie not to mention. I don't know if you guys have seen this movie. It's called Dark Water, and it's from 2002. So more than a decade before Elisa Lam went missing. And even if you haven't seen the movie, I can tell you the premise. It's about a girl who falls into a water tank at the top of a hotel and she drowns. And then the water that, you know, is now infected with her body creeps down into the hotel walls and eventually taints the hotel water, which makes the people in the hotel start complaining about the taste of the water. And that sounds exactly like actually what we have here. And what's even creepier is that in Dark Water, there's a scene involving a bizarre episode in an elevator, which obviously calls to mind the video that we just watched and talked about. And this movie was actually remade in 2005. And two of the characters in the 2005 remake are called Dahlia and Cece, which align roughly with the Black Dahlia and the Cecil Hotel. Again, this may have nothing to do with the case, and we have no reason to believe that it does, but it just seems to map on so closely to our case at hand that it's worth noting.
Yeah, it's just strange. It's just another strange thing about this case. I don't think you can really say this has anything to do with Elisa Lam's death, but the similarities between that movie, and I've seen that movie, and the Elisa Lam case, I mean, they're not perfect. Obviously, there's a lot of differences, but there are a lot of similarities too. And it's no surprise that when people initially hear about Elisa Lam's case, they think about this movie. So there are other synchronicities people talk about. We're not really going to get into some of them. I think a lot of them are kind of weak. You can find them online. These are the ones that really sort of stood out to us and we thought were significant enough to mention. Well, I think that's all the time we have. I know we said we were going to finish this today, but we want to be thorough and we want to go through all the important stuff with you guys. And we also want to break these things down into easily consumed bites. I know I listened to one podcast and the guy never does multiple episodes. So sometimes he'll do 3.5 hours in one episode, and that's great. And he's really thorough, but that's hard to listen to in a 20-minute commute. Anyway, we'll see you guys tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to go through some of these depositions. I think this is an area we can really add something. We're not broadcasters, as we said before, but we are lawyers. And we wanted to bring some things that people haven't seen before. And these depositions just aren't available online yet, but they will be. So take care of yourself, Alice, in quarantine.
You too, Brett.
Say hello to your lovely children for me.
I will. I always do. Thank you guys all for joining us for part two of Elisa Lam. And we can't wait to welcome you back next time. Until then, I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And we are the prosecutors.
And that worked really well last time.
Oh, good.
That was Annie's idea, by the way. She wanted to make sure that you knew it was her idea. So
I just assumed any good idea is hers. You can tell her that.
Yeah, that's